Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast of SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and Madison Computer Works. Joining me now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Well, as we record this on this cold Wisconsin Friday morning, God is my witness, when I called you last night, John, I did not know that this was going to happen the very next morning. And of course, this is the news that broke on Friday morning.
Good morning, America. Breaking news as we come on the air. President Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, charged in the Russia investigation. We're live with the latest. Roger Stone, you see him right there. President Trump's longtime political advisor, former campaign aide, has been arrested in Florida, charged by special counsel Robert Mueller with obstruction, witness tampering, making false statements to Congress, all connected to what he knew about the hacking of Hillary Clinton's emails during the 2016 campaign and what he told the Trump campaign about those leaks. Our Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas starts us off. Good morning, Pierre.
George, good morning. That's right. Roger Stone, longtime associate and sometimes informal Trump advisor, was arrested overnight in Fort Lauderdale and charged with 7 federal felonies, obstruction of an official proceeding, 5 counts of making false statements, and 1 count of witness tampering. George, much of this appears to be about WikiLeaks, which obtained hacked information about the DNC and Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta and then released the documents during the 2016 campaign. The U.S. intelligence community concluded that the documents, which included embarrassing information about the Clinton campaign, was hacked by the Russian government in an effort to help the Trump campaign. According to the charges, in the summer of 2016, Stone spoke to senior Trump campaign officials about WikiLeaks and, quote, information it might have that would be damaging to the Clinton campaign. Stone was then contacted by a senior campaign official who inquired about future releases by WikiLeaks. According to the indictment, once Stone learned that congressional intelligence committees and the FBI had opened investigations regarding Russian interference in the 2016 election, Stone took steps to obstruct the investigations. The special counsel claims that Stone made false statements to the House Intelligence Committee and denied processing or possessing records that contained evidence of his interactions with WikiLeaks, and the special counsel says he attempted to persuade a witness to provide false testimony. George, is a very lengthy indictment. We're still pouring through it. Much more to come, George.
There's
much more to come, George.
It's a very interesting development, don't you think?
So for people that are listening to this podcast today or tomorrow or whenever, tell people a little bit about this character, Roger Stone. Is he a good player or a bad player?
Well, I believe that Richard Nixon and various people since then, almost all of them either, you know, targets of impeachment, indictment, or other, you know, investigations, have thought he's a good character. The interesting thing about Roger Stone is that he is someone who connects many of the bad players throughout history. You know, it's sort of like you say, well, you know, there can't really be a straight line from, say, Nixon to Trump, can there? And then you go, oh, I guess there is, because Roger Stone's been there as a player around so many of the nefarious figures within the Republican Party and beyond its fringe. He has always played sort of a dark side of politics. He has been a quite well-regarded political player at some times, quite close to the center of action. He has run campaigns, or at least been, you know, in the advisory zone of a lot of campaigns over the years. He's interestingly enough been something of a, if you dare say this, a moderate Republican. He hasn't been, you know, like the scorching right winger.
Putting his ideology aside,
yeah.
I know he's not Stephen Miller. Would you compare him? Who was that fella that hung around the Romanovs? Is that Rasputin?
No, because I think Rasputin had some honorable character.
Okay.
But, no, I'm teasing. I think Rasputin probably is a pretty bad guy, too. But in reality, yeah, there's this, that was where I was getting to. While he has positioned as something of a moderate Republican at some times over the years, especially on some social issues, he has always been interested in getting very close to power. And that's the key thing with Roger Stone. He looks for people with money and political power, and he does things for them. There's even, you know, it's like a documentary that was done on him that is, and I hope I get the title right, I may be a little off on it, but something along of Get Me Roger Stone. You know, and it's the notion that when you're in trouble, when you have a problem, when you need something done that's maybe a little bit on the margins, I know, you call Roger Stone in. And so that's why this moment is so important, because if there is someone who was linking the Trump campaign, potentially Trump himself, to players outside the United States who might have wanted to influence the election, and also to players within the United States who might have had nefarious goals, or, you know, might in some way have been people that the campaign did not want to directly connect with, there is a chance, and certainly there has been the suggestion, that Roger Stone is the guy who made those connections.
Now, he hadn't been on the campaign since early in 2015, but the president had constant contact with him. We hear about these late-night long phone calls, and yet the Trump administration wants us to believe that they didn't talk about WikiLeaks. They didn't have any conversations about any of that other stuff going on.
That's like Michael Cohen and Trump didn't talk about anything.
Right.
Right? You know, look, here's the bottom line. Donald Trump has many clear patterns of how he operates, right, of how he does things. And the one thing that's important to understand is Donald Trump doesn't fire people. Right? People are forced out, they resign, you know, sometimes they are removed, quote unquote, but they usually circle back, you know, like, I don't know, the next day. And it's an important thing to understand. I learned this in writing the book on Trump, and people would say to me, I wrote about all of Trump's associates and cabinet members and appointees, and people said, yeah, but, you know, he is such a changeable guy, such a whim-driven character, you know, these people won't be in their positions permanently. Like, Bannon won't always be there. You know, other people won't always be there. And I said, wrong. They will always be there. It's just they may be pushed aside because they're scandal-plagued. Trump doesn't really care. He still keeps talking to him. He keeps interacting with him. The only place at which Trump goes against you is if you turn on him, if you're, like, testifying against him, campaigning against him, then there's a problem. But, I always remind people that, you know, people think now, for instance, oh, Bannon's separate from Trump. I promise you that if Trump's at a certain pivot point in his reelection campaign, if he makes it to that point, which I'm not sure he will, Bannon will be back. I guarantee you. And the same can be said of Roger Stone. Roger Stone is that kind of guy who will circle in, circle out, be close, be a little bit further. The reality is, for a very long time, he has been a permanent part of the Trump circle, and he has been a permanent part of the Trump circle because he does things for people with money.
You know, in some ways, he and Trump are kind of similar, is that they have both rather openly flaunted playing on the edges, almost like this is a little game, a little cat and mouse game, and I think they truly, really never thought it would get to this point.
No, but they're always willing to go. If you know, it's sort of like, do you want to jump off this cliff? Yeah, let's do it. You know, it's like they grab opportunity because they are both players who know they're not that good at what they do. You know what I mean? That they are, because of wealth, privilege, connections, they are in circles where they can grab opportunities, and they long ago learned that you don't turn those opportunities down, you grab them. And so, yeah, they are similar characters, and the person that they extend from is Joe McCarthy's assistant, aide, you know, henchman, Roy Cohn. And
he wasn't a very nice man.
He was a very bad man. But Roy Cohn was a aide to McCarthy, then a New York lawyer and fixer who knew an awful lot of these people and, you know, really kind of set a, I don't know, for lack of a better term, set a style for it, right? And the interesting thing is the style, the approach was bigger than life and no apologies for your kind of scandals, your wrongdoing. You get caught in something, you don't apologize, you just barrel right on. And in fact, to some extent, you embrace it. And this is, you know, if you study how totalitarians, how authoritarians, you know, kind of advance their image, how they do things, that's what they do, right? And I'm not, it's not to make some big judgment on Trump or to make some big judgment on any particular person. It's to say this is an approach to power, and it is to be in power and then to refuse to apologize when you get caught or something because it makes you look strong. And I think you can fairly say that is something that Trump and Roger Stone, and going back even to Roy Cohn, Roy's quite obsessed with.
Power. All right.
Power and looking strong with power.
All right, let's take a break. Let's take a break, and then we will pick it up with what's going on with the government shutdown and all the other things going on next. John Nichols with us at SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
And welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers, also our friends at Madison Teamsters Local 695, Madison Firefighters Local 311, and of course Madison Teachers Incorporated. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation with us today as we talk about all the craziness in Washington. It was really quite a series of Marie Antoinette moments with some of the Trump administration. We'll start out, we'll gradually increase in the severity. We'll start out with Lawrence Kudlow.
As soon as this thing goes, the switch will be turned on, the payments will be made, we will go back to normal. This is just a glitch. I don't think I'm out of touch. I'm addressing the problem. I mean, I've met with my individual staff members, and God bless them. They're working for free. They're volunteering.
How are they volunteering? How are workers who've been recalled without pay volunteering?
They're coming to work. They're showing up.
That's not volunteering if you're forced to work without pay and if you don't show up, you lose your job. So that's not volunteering. That's not what volunteering means.
They do it because of their love for the country and the office of the presidency and presumably their allegiance to President Trump, but whatever, they're doing it. Give them some credit.
Then we go to Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary.
We've had shutdowns before, albeit for not such a long period as we've been thus far. But put it in perspective, you're talking about 800,000 workers. And while I feel sorry for the individuals that have hardship cases, 800,000 workers, if they never got their pay, which is not the case, they will eventually get it.
Mr. Secretary, there are reports that there are some federal workers who are going to homeless shelters to get food.
Well, I know they are, and I don't really quite understand why, because as I mentioned before, the obligations that they would undertake, say a borrowing from a bank or a credit union, are in effect federally guaranteed. So the 30 days of pay that some people will be out There's no real reason why they shouldn't be able to get a loan against it.
Then, finally, the coup de grace, the man in charge. I know he doesn't think the buck stops with him, but it does.
I really heard the statement, but I do understand that perhaps he should have said it differently. Local people know who they are when they go for groceries and everything else. And I think what Wilbur is probably trying to say is that they will work along. And that's what happens in time like this. They know the people. They've been dealing with them for years, and they work along. The grocery store. And I think that's probably what Wilbur Ross meant.
You know, it's kind of like when Mr. Douglas would go into town, into Hooterville, and stop by and see Sam Drucker, right?
Yeah, except with billionaires.
Right.
You know, I mean, just the only difference is that the genius of Petticoat Junction and Green Acres and Beverly Hills was that while they did sometimes intersect with people of wealth and even accomplish a little bit of wealth by, you know, finding some, I guess, you know, black gold, Texas crude, they were essentially working class people. And if they were bumbling in some way, you know, that was, you know, they were bumbling in some way. What we have with the Secretary of Commerce of the United States, the principal economic advisor to the President of the United States, and the President of the United States, people you just played there, is people who have traveled in circles of immense wealth, who themselves have had immense wealth, but intriguingly enough, have invariably been bailed out when they screwed up, right? And in the case of the President, screwed up massively. And in fact, Wilbur Ross is the guy who literally helped to bail Trump out in his bankruptcies. That's why Trump likes Wilbur Ross so much. Is, you know, not that Wilbur Ross is particularly good at things or a particularly nice guy. He isn't. His track record is horrific. It's because he literally is the guy who found money for Trump. And it was very easy for him. You know, when you set up a bank in Cyprus and you know, start cutting deals with the old Deutsche Bank people and stuff like that, you'd be amazed how much money flows around. The problem is that the average federal employee is not able to set up a bank in Cyprus or to, you know, like travel in the circles of Russian oligarchs. And so this notion by Trump and Kudlow and Ross that there's sort of free money out there. You know, if you get into a little bit of financial trouble, you know, you just say, call somebody up and say, yeah, I'm going bankrupt. Can you, you know, open the spigot so things work out for me? That's not anybody except them. And in fact, much of what you and I have talked about in many of these discussions as regards the corruption, the scandals, the wrongdoing, the compromises of values and principles that characterize the Trump administration extend from that free money game. Right? So many of the scandals that we know of in this administration and that we anticipate with this administration track back to it. And so working people, federal employees, who are not able to turn on the spigots of free money, who are not able and not willing to sell their souls, are being told by people who have had, you know, a free ride that somehow they're incomprehensible.
It makes
people are going to soup kitchens, right? Why would they do that?
It makes George Herbert Walker Bush and the grocery scanner look pretty innocent, doesn't it?
Oh, no, those were patricians. I mean, even, you know, Barbara Bush and some of her troublesome statements about, you know, people who'd been dislocated from Louisiana and things of that nature, you know, there's a root in ignorance. And, you know, certainly a measure of having lived a pampered life. But that is different from what you've got in the case of this Trump circle. Because these are not merely people who live pampered lives. No question, Donald Trump has been pampered all his life. But there are also people who got in by their own moves in the case of Trump. And even in the case of Rothstein, got into really troublesome situations and then got out because they knew people with money. You know, the average clerk or, you know, data input person or Coast Guard person or, even FBI agents. These aren't people who, you know, can pick up the phone and arrange a no-interest loan from some foreign entity.
Well, what I've noticed since the media has covered many government workers that are in terrible predicaments, and I know you don't spend a lot of time on Facebook, but I do, and I see the posts of the Trump supporters trashing the government workers, talking about the bureaucracy and their babies, and they've got better health care. Trump says he loves federal workers, but his base, they've turned on these government workers.
Well, and this is like Scott Walker. Remember that Grover Norquist said that it all started with Scott Walker, that Scott Walker is really our touchstone for understanding so much of how Trump does things and, you know, the Trump approach. And, of course, what did Scott Walker build his administration in Wisconsin on? Telling us that public employees somehow had some tremendous deal, right? That everything was so great for them, and it just needed to be dialed back. And this is emblematic of what conservatism is. And it's important to understand that conservatism is a movement in the contemporary era. Not historically, it had much more honorable players, but that in the contemporary era has been built largely on the demonization of government, and to make that work, the demonization of government employees.
All right.
And
so
that's what's made, I think, this shutdown in their head possible.
So clearly Mitch McConnell is starting to freak out. He lost 6 votes the other day on the Trump proposal. Ron Johnson is starting to freak out and point fingers at Mitch McConnell. Here's a moment in the Senate the other day where Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who just barely got reelected, went up against Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado.
The Democrats are fond of using the phrase hostage taking. They are quite literally holding the men and women of the Coast Guard hostage because they want to win a political victory against the president. Their objective here is have the president back down and have not a single mile of border wall built.
These crocodile tears that the senator from Texas is crying for first responders are too hard for me to take. They're too hard for me to take. Because when the senator from Texas shut this government down in 2013, my state was flooded. It was underwater. People were killed. People's houses were destroyed. Their small businesses were ruined forever. How ludicrous it is that this government is shut down over a promise the President of the United States couldn't keep.
There you go. And I will tell you...
That's about perfect.
The fact that Ted Cruz didn't understand the glass house he was living in on that subject was pretty remarkable.
It is, in fact, pretty remarkable. And frankly, with all due respect, you mentioned to Ron Johnson a moment ago. You know, these Republican senators are so scorchingly ignorant. They are such pampered sons of privilege who have lived such protected lives for so long.
Oh, I thought you were going to say sons of something else.
No, sons of privilege. And I know that Ted Cruz's family actually had to work a little bit along the way, and even Ron Johnson had to marry into it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is they have lived in their little bubbles for so long. I think that this pushback against their pure BS, you know, their absurd statements, is shocking to them. I don't think they anticipated this because they haven't been called out very much. And now suddenly they're starting to panic. They're starting to say absurd things beyond the usual absurdity to try and justify, to try and, you know, suddenly put themselves on the side of the workers. You know, that's what Ted Cruz is trying to do there, right? He's like, oh, I want to stand up for the Coast Guard. They live in glass houses. And they have enjoyed the view for so long that they don't know how vulnerable they are. And Ted Cruz almost got beat in the last election. I can tell you that if I would love to have an election this year, I'd love to have an election tomorrow, right? Because the fact of the matter is, I think Ted Cruz would be voted out of the Senate in a second. I think Ron Johnson would be voted out of the Senate in a second. Because these people are guiltier than Trump. And that's important to understand. Donald Trump would either back down or be sidelined if you simply had the majority of Republicans in the Senate side with the Democrats to open the government up. That's all that it would require. You have to be able to override any veto from Trump, and you know, you have to be able to, you know, send a clear signal. But understand, Donald Trump is a problem here. He's a crisis, but he is always a problem. He is always a crisis. So when you have a permanent barrier, you figure out how to go around it, right? You figure out, you know, what to do with it. And so the operative problem here, the reality of our crisis right now, is Ted Cruz and Ron Johnson and people like that. And they can whine all they want, but they are personally responsible for this continuing.
Before we go, I have to talk to you about Tony Evers and his first State of the State address. Mm-hmm. The biggest applause line of the night, clearly, at least on the Democratic side, was when Governor Evers said this.
Johnson voted for a change this November and asked us to stop playing politics with her health care. That's why I'm announcing tonight that I have fulfilled the promise I made to the people of Wisconsin by directing Attorney General Call to withdraw from a lawsuit that would gut coverage for the 2.4 million Wisconsinites who have pre-existing conditions.
That was the big applause line of the night, and 24 hours later, that statement is no longer operative. Not a good moment.
No, and I think the applause was genuine, right? It was, you know, often in a State of State address, like a State of the Union address, applause is practiced, right? It is a response at the point where you're expected to respond. In that case, I think you heard, especially Democrats in the legislature, folks in the galleries, applauding and saying, wow, you know, Tony Evers is, you know, he's putting the marker down. He is saying that he's going to fight this issue and get us out of this absurd lawsuit. And then to 24 hours later say, oh, well, hold on, I guess, you know, I'm not sure we could do that or whatever. That's not how you do it. You know, the proper stance is, you know, I don't mind that he said that. I think that he's saying the speech is fine thing. But it should have been a little clearer. He should have said, I'm asking Josh Call to find a way to get out of this lawsuit, right? To take the steps that are necessary. And if that involves, you know, coming back to me and we have to do legislative things or we have to fight on some of these issues, let's do it. Right? Because that's the promise I made, that I'm going to stick to this promise. And even if there was a lack of clarity in that, in the speech, 24 hours later, if there's pushback on it and he's in it, his statement should be, I promise to do this during the campaign. I'm going to bend every effort to do it. And I'm telling Josh Call, let's figure out how to do this. Let's work on this. Let's make it a priority. Instead, this, to come off it and seem to be, uncertain about your own power or uncertain about, you know, your goal or how you're gonna move there. No, it's not the way to do it.
And then in his response, this is Robin Voss. You may remember Robin Voss.
Very familiar with the man.
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
He's my mom's state rep.
I do understand that. He's from Rochester, Wisconsin.
As President Ronald Reagan once said, as government expands, liberty contracts. He also said, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. Let me promise you, Republicans in the legislature won't forget Ronald Reagan's sentiments. We won't let government grow out of control, and we won't let socialism take root in our state.
It's too late.
I think he must, I wonder if that thought occurred to him as he was driving over the Dan Hone Bridge in Milwaukee. Bridge named for the longest-serving socialist mayor of Milwaukee. And, you know, that statement, which obviously somebody gave him a Ronald Reagan quote book for Christmas or something, you know, that statement is rooted in deep ignorance of Wisconsin and the theory that you can take national talking points and apply them to the greatest state in the nation, the best state in the nation, a really, really cool state. Wisconsin is cool and stands out because it's more interesting. It's had a richer, deeper political history than other states, and it's had real right-wingers. It's had Joe McCarthy, no question of that. But it has also had great progressives like Robert M. La Follette. And it has a rich socialist tradition, not just in Milwaukee, but in, you know, up in Wausau, down in Racine, across this state. You've had socialist mayors, socialist city council members, socialist state legislators. And you know what the interesting thing is? 100 years ago, do you know who Republicans in the legislature worked with frequently? Socialists. The socialists were the main opposition party in the legislature, but they often found, you know, huge areas of cooperation in the 1920s, 1930s with progressive Republicans, and many of the great advances in Wisconsin, things that we celebrate, were products of cooperation between Republicans, Robin Voss's, you know, antecedents, and socialists. And so I'm afraid it took root, and I'm afraid that Robin Voss might want to put aside those talking points he got from somebody in Washington and start paying a little more attention to Wisconsin.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation, thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
Pleasure, my friend.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, 5 more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.